Mildred watched the Panamanian coastline flash by. Staggered ranks of round-topped mountains dark with jungle, and closer in, the brilliant flash of white surf breaking along miles of deserted beaches. She shifted her sitting position on the ship's deck, fighting the numbing vibration of twin diesels as much as she could, given the minimal slack in her restraints. Her four companions, the shit-weasel Firetalker, the three white coats, and their warrior priest captors were running north from Panama City, and had been for almost 8 hours straight. Their transportation had been upgraded considerably, from horse carts to a 36-foot Bertram Sportfisher. Mildred estimated their cruising speed at 25 knots or better. It was plenty fast enough to cool off the sweltering air and evaporate the sweat dripping down her face and running under her arms. The going was actually quite pleasant for a change. This was the easiest part of the journey so far. Of course, it would have been even better if she and the others hadn't been chained to the rails of the Bertram's stern deck bait well. There hadn't been enough room around the well to hook Daniel up alongside them and still guarantee his safety, so he was fastened about 6 feet away, to the base of the port outrigger. That was nothing to cry over either. The overland crossing of the Panamanian Isthmus had been a 3-day, 2-night ordeal. The 2 nights were spent in outposts along the old canal route, in secure bunkers built into hillside caves. They were big enough to house a mule train, and they had their own freshwater cisterns. It was still unclear what their captors were afraid of, but their tension escalated as the sun began to set. They had pushed the horses hard to reach shelter before nightfall. Whatever it was the warrior priests were scared of, it didn't have the brains or the dexterity to open the bunker doors from the outside between occupations, and thereby lie in wait for the next convoy. Although Mildred never saw anything moving, the forest on all sides had come alive with breaking brush and shrill screams as evening descended. She had to wonder if there were muties in the Panamanian jungle, the same sort of brutal chillers that infested Deathlands. Or were there brand new ones? Or was the muty plague limited to the hellscape and the ground plowed and planted by the all-out nuclear exchange? Or had the stickies and scalies of the hellscape just not migrated this far south yet? She had lots of questions, no answers. By unspoken agreement, the companions had begun ditching their food at every meal. The Fire Talker caught them at it on the first day on the trail, but instead of turning them into the white coats, he demanded they give him what they weren't going to eat themselves. He wasn't really that desperate for extra rations, but he wanted more drugs. He wanted more oblivion. And the companions gladly accommodated him. It not only got rid of most of the evidence, it also shut him up. On the afternoon of the third day, they had reached the shore of the Pacific. As it turned out, the rupture of the canal's Pacific end locks and the outflowing of Miraflores Lake, which was a teacup compared to the artificial reservoir on the Atlantic side, hadn't devastated Panama City at all. Though its infrastructure had survived the canal's destruction on Skydark more or less intact, Panama City's population had entirely vanished. As with Colon, the jungle had taken it back. For different reasons. Along the fractured eroding highway on the edge of the city, they had seen crude hand-painted signs, warning signs that looked weathered, many decades old. Plaga, plague. Mildred had wondered if it was the same one that had devastated Padre Island. What were the odds of a second, incredibly deadly, unheard-of bioweapon popping up in this neck of the woods? Slim and none, she figured. The simplest answer was usually the right answer. So said Occam's razor. The little convoy had continued on, past the warning signs, toward a jagged skyline of towering buildings that framed a placid bay. There was no way of telling whether the disease was still in evidence, but there were definitely dangers of other kinds. Down a broad, creeper-covered side street, Mildred had seen a sleek black jaguar loping along, hunting for dinner. High above it, flocks of noisy scarlet macaw glided between the broken-out windows of high-rise towers. The companions had spent their third night out of Colon with a warrior priest garrison, bivouacked in the old Panama City yacht harbor. The yacht basin was either a safe distance from the plague zone of the central city, or the plague had in fact burned itself out. The harbor had been turned into a transit point for small craft shipping, both commercial and passenger. There were a dozen converted pleasure craft moored there, sail and powerboats from 30 to 65 feet long. The Mattachine evidently had access to the intact fuel stores of Panama City, and probably enough diesel to last them another 100 years. Mildred couldn't be sure whether the introduction of the plague to Panama City had come before or after the bioweapon had been used in Mexico on the Atlantic side. The destruction and loss of life in Panama City had definitely gotten out of control, though. There was no strategic advantage to completely wiping out a population of what had to have been at least 1 million people. The jungle that had invaded the city had been fertilized by all those rotting corpses. Killing everyone only complicated the pirates' conquest. There was no one left to do any other work, and a disease quarantine put the city's bounty out of immediate reach, which led Mildred to believe that this had to have been an earlier deployment of the weapon, perhaps even the first deployment, before the pirates realized the full extent of what it could do and how fast it could spread. Perhaps the citizens of Panama City had successfully resisted the Mattachine incursions up to that point. Certainly, they would have had the sheer numbers to turn back invaders. For what it was worth, the birds, monkeys, and jaguar seemed to be immune to the plague. During the night they had spent on the waterfront, the fire talker's ebullient mood, fueled by multiple doses of opiate, had turned suddenly darker. He began talking to himself like a man possessed, using the absurd voices of his absurd characters as they confronted his abusive and long-dead parents. It made sleep impossible. Mildred turned her attention toward the Bertram's bow as the little white coats and one of the warriors escorted Christy back to the baitwell. This after a trip to the Salon's head. While the women scientists reattached Christie's manacles to the stainless steel rub rail, the soldier held the muzzle of his submachine gun to the back of her skull. Resistance was impossible. After their captors returned to the air-conditioned Salon, Christy leaned closer.
Mildred, I think I know where they're taking us. I saw a nautical chart laid out on a table. The course was plotted on a plastic overlay. We're headed for an island called Coiba.
The dictator, Noriega, used to torture his political prisoners there. This was back in the 1980s, before he was overthrown by the U.S. invasion. It was a maximum security prison back then. A prison hidden deep in the jungle. An awful place, by all accounts. They called it the Devil's Island of Panama.
So they renamed it Xibalba?
Trying to remember the mythology I used to know. Well, I'm pretty sure Xibalba was supposed to be hidden somewhere in Guatemala, and it was supposed to be below ground, a vast cavern with apartments, palaces, a council place, and rooms with various harrowing trials for visitors. The Lords of Death were supposed to be human-like, whatever that means.
Doc raised a brow and leaned closer as well.
Perhaps it refers to bipedalism, stereoscopic color vision, opposable thumbs?
Who knows? It's just a thousand-year-old folktale.
I know.
They all stared at the man in the net suit. He finally seemed to have stirred from his day-long stupor. JB gave him a dubious look.
Oh, you're gonna fill us in now?
Why not? We're almost there. That dark hump on the horizon is Xibalba.
What do you know about it?
Before Skydark, I volunteered for an ultra-secret experiment. I didn't know where I was going or what I was getting into when I signed on. By the time I figured it out, it was too late. The experimentation on Coiba didn't go as planned. I was infected, but I didn't die. I carried the plague in my blood. I was given a choice by the Whitecoats. Live out the rest of my life on the island. I'll go into cryostasis until a cure could be found. When I was reanimated, there was no cure, and the Atapuls had been in command of the prison and in command of the Mattachine for close to a century.
Who are the Atapuls?
They're the offspring of convicts who escaped into the island bush. Criminal royalty whose lineage stretches back to before Armageddon. I was in a cryo tank on Nuke Day when escaped prisoners returned from the jungle and took over the prison. I wasn't the first carrier they reanimated over the years. There were plenty of others to choose from. Like I said, the project was a disaster, start to finish.
Why are they bringing you back here now? What do they want with the five of us?
Daniel lowered his head, his eyes glazed.
I don't know.
Tell us, you piece of shit!
The fire talker sobbed weakly into his hands until he appeared to slip back into a drugged sleep. There was no rousing him from it. Mildred turned her attention to the island looming off the starboard bow. Looking at it, she felt no curiosity, no anger, only dread. Coiba was immense and separated from the mainland by 50 shark-filled miles of ocean. As they got closer, she could make out the shoreline. Convoluted blobs of black lava formed sheer cliffs that were crashed by white surf and topped by a vast, seemingly impenetrable rainforest. There were dots of color scattered here and there among the branches and drooping vines, bright yellow flowers that could have been wild orchids. A wall of heat hit them as the Bertram glided into a protected cove. Two other pleasure craft, a 28-foot Aquasport center console and a 32-foot Pursuit, were moored in close to shore, with no crews in sight. The water dropped off steeply from the curve of white, sandy beach. The beach was on a finger of land, and on the far side of the land, a sluggish green river flowed into the sea. Nibor and his men anchored the boat, then unchained the prisoners and Daniel, and forced them into an inflatable dinghy. Although doped to the gills, Daniel came to at the last moment.
No! I don't want to go!
He had to be dragged from the Bertram.
No!
They rowed the passengers the short distance ashore in a huge inflatable dinghy. The warrior priests brought their RPDs along with them and some extra 100-round drum mags. Obviously, they considered the intended route to Xibalba as dangerous as the journey across the isthmus. The reasons for the weapons immediately became apparent. Crocodiles sunned themselves on the riverside of the beach, not 30 yards from their landing site. These creatures were 15 feet long and more than a yard across the widest part of their rib cages. The saltwater crocs didn't seem interested in the visitors. Or perhaps they weren't within easy enough eating distance. Nibor and his crew ignored them in return. The companions were overheated and soaked by the time they struggled ashore in their chains. With three warrior priests on point, followed by the companions, the white coats Daniel and a two-man rear guard, they followed the sliver of land to the edge of the forest, then ducked under the rainforest canopy. It was smotheringly hot in the deep shade, like a bake oven. The trail was narrow and winding. They had to walk single file. Visibility was no more than 10 feet ahead. The jungle off the trail was so thick that escape to either side was impossible. There was nowhere to run. Nibor and his crew immediately unsheathed their machetes. Snakes, Mildred knew, were dispatched with machetes more easily than machine guns, especially in this kind of close quarter. Even if there weren't any muties lurking in the deep shadows, there were 1,000 other ways to die in this place, all of them excruciating. From the way the warrior priests clutched their weapons, they felt ambush or attack was likely at any moment. After they had trekked in about 2 miles up and down the sides of steep ravines, waded shallow creeks, and were drenched in sweat, Nibor stopped the advance with a hand signal. Mildred suddenly realized that the jungle noises had gone suddenly silent. Nibor listened for a moment, then turned to his men.
The dogs are coming.
The news set the white-coated women into wide-eyed fear. They clutched each other's hands and hung on for dear life. For his part, Dr. Monteo looked like he was about to swallow his own tongue. The warrior priests in the lead took off running. The pair at the rear drove the middle of the file onward, kicking and shoving at them to try to make them go faster. Another 200 yards up the path, and they had to hop over and around body parts, strewed along 30 yards of trail. Clods of meat sprouted bristly tufts of hair. Uncoiled gray intestines festooned the low branches. Bloody, shattered bones lay everywhere. To Mildred, It looked like the remains of a boar or wild pig, recently torn to shreds, dismembered, gutted, and left there to rot. Farther on, the decapitated head lay on its cheek at the edge of the trail, the head of a huge boar, with upcurving yellow tusks the size of bowie knives. Anything that could rip apart something of that size was big trouble, even with machine guns. Mildred stared into the jungle. She couldn't tell where the animals were. Encirclement and the horror that entailed was clearly a possibility, and the column was losing ground to the pursuit, its speed slowed by the captives and their ankle manacles. But there was no time to stop to remove them. Nibor quickly took measure of the problem, and in a stunning bit of command decision nastiness, he whipped his machine gun around on its shoulder sling and fired a single round, shooting one of his own men through the thigh. The wounded man dropped to the ground, clutching his leg as he writhed in pain. The rest of the line, pirates, prisoners, and white coats, ran on, leaving him behind to occupy and slow the dog pack. He had the misfortune of being the least valuable member of the group, therefore, the obvious choice for sacrifice. Nibor's act of betrayal had bought them a little time, just enough time, as it turned out. The trail ended at the old prison gates and a perimeter of rusting hurricane fence topped by razor wire. The massive gates swung open at their approach just enough that the pirates, the white coats, and their prisoners could squeeze through before the gates swung back and slammed closed. The companions stumbled to a stop and huddled together for a moment. On the far side of the entrance, Mildred could see the rainforest canopy had been cleared to the bare ground in an acres-wide circle. Sunlight streamed in, unfiltered. Mildred had visited the Mayan ruins at Palenque and Tikal, and she had always imagined Xibalba as being something architecturally similar. Steep-sided, white limestone pyramids with unbroken rows of stone steps and broad cobblestone thoroughfares to accommodate religious festivals and parades. Massive sculpted stone faces and elaborate hieroglyphs for decoration. Maybe a road of crushed white rock or shell leading in. This Xibalba was none of those. Beyond the gates, in the center of the expanse of flat ground, was a densely packed complex of one- and two-story windowless concrete buildings. Modern, purely functional buildings. The site seemed to be unchanged from what it had been more than a century ago. It still looked like a maximum security prison. At one time, the concrete had probably been painted a warm gold. Now that color could barely be seen between the streaks of black mildew that striped all the walls. One of the low buildings looked newer. At least, it was slightly more beige than mildewed. Protecting the cluster of prison buildings was a second razor-wire-topped hurricane fence. It formed a 12-foot-high hexagon around the compound, and at each of the 6 points there was a 20-foot-tall guard tower with a spotlight. From where Mildred stood, it didn't appear that any of the towers were manned. The warrior priests made sure that the entry gates behind them were secure, and then pushed the companions on toward Xibalba proper. As they approached the second, much smaller gate, Mildred perked up her ears. Christy looked at her.
Diesel generators.
Between the barrier fence and the mildewed buildings, there were about 200 people. Some were performing menial tasks, tending gardens or animals, moving materials in wheelbarrows, digging ditches and the like. But most were just milling around aimlessly. It reminded Mildred of a squalid third-world farmer's market, or perhaps a Renaissance fair in hell. Greasy smoke from a row of roasting meats wafted over them. The skinned and gutted carcasses of some very large animals were being turned on spits over beds of heaped coals. Crocodile? Deer? Wild boar? Brown women, naked to the waist, basted the crisping haunches with rag mops. To Mildred, the joy on their faces seemed excessive and patently false. As in, look extra happy or die extra horribly. Then she realized with a shock that the broad grins they wore had been surgically installed, the muscles of their cheeks trimmed and then pinned to the bone, the corners of their mouths permanently upturned with the tip of a scalpel. Nibor led the chained companions toward a two-story building with a single row of narrow wire-glassed windows just below the edge of the roof. To reach the structure, they had to run a gauntlet of perpetually smiling supplicants lined up on either side of the path. Some of them were plastic surgery catastrophes, their faces and bodies horribly mutilated. Attempts to join plastic, metal, and bone had gone awry, and massive infection had resulted. Mildred could not for the life of her figure out what they were lined up for. Not food, surely. Food was everywhere and apparently free for the taking. Not clothing, because they had clothes and it was too hot to wear much of it anyway. A payment of some kind? Or some special entertainment? Neither of those seemed likely either. Then, the truth struck her.
These grinning bootlickers and insignificant demons are waiting for audiences with the Lords of Death.
Mildred had a sudden, and under the circumstances, jarringly incongruous flashback. The closed double doors that loomed in front of them reminded her of high school gym class. Nibor and the warrior priests ushered the chained companions into the old prison's basketball stadium. The details of her reading on the ancient Maya came back to her in a rush. A central feature of the myths of Xibalba was how much the Lords of Death loved their ball game, which they played with a razor-studded ball and a horizontal stone hoop. The basketball backboards from the Noriega days were long gone, but Mildred could still make out the remnants of the free throw line on the concrete floor. Across the court, in the two top rows of the bleachers, the Lords of Death awaited. Mildred did a quick count. There were 36 of them, three times as many as there should have been. They sat as still as statues, in full head masks. The masks were garishly painted. They had the same stylized animal maws, pop eyes, and lolling tongues as the papier-mâché heads on sticks and Veracruz. Mildred was too far away to see eyes glittering behind the eye holes. The lords wore loose, flowing robes and sandals, like pharaohs or Roman senators. She couldn't recognize any of the masks from the banners and models she'd seen in Mexico. She'd been too distracted at the time to take proper note. Stationed along the narrow end of the court to her left were at least 50 more of the jungle-camouflaged paramilitaries. The sectmen for the Lords of Death all had shaved heads. Most were ritually scarred like Dogface. They carried light automatic weapons, the same stubby 9mm submachine guns as their Mattachine brethren. Their position gave them clear firing lanes down the length of the court. If there was trouble in Xibalba, they could sweep it away in an instant with sustained bursts of autofire. Mildred noted the chest-high clusters of bullet holes in the concrete of the opposite wall. It looked like a firing squad backstop. The only game played on this court was stand still while I shoot you. Dr. Monteo and his assistants hurried over to join the six other white coats gathered at the foot of the bleachers. One of the men, much younger and shorter than Monteo, with sweeping wings of black hair parted in the middle, shoved a stiffened finger in his face.
Monteo, you idiot! How dare you bring back only five? What am I to do with five? They will likely all die.
My apologies, Dr. Yorte.
Shut up!
As the wild-eyed young white coat took Monteo to task, he swept the plaits of hair out of his eyes with both hands. This was a gesture he repeated every few seconds. A nervous tick, to be sure.
Worship and tremble! I am Atapul the Tenth, first among the Lords of Death!
Because of the echoes in the cavernous room, it was impossible to tell which, if any, of the 36 seated lords had spoken. One of Nibor's paramilitaries grabbed hold of the back of Mildred's neck and forced her to kneel on the floor and genuflect. Nose pressed to the concrete, Mildred managed to turn her head and steal a peek as one of the masked figures, presumably the speaker, slowly stood. The rest of the lords sat there like mannequins. The mask worn by Atapul Ten was the stylized head of a jaguar, painted black with a headdress of a fan of red snakes, all poised to strike. The cat face had great long fangs and a lolling purple tongue. Even with the outsized mask on his head, Atapul X appeared to be an impressively wide-shouldered specimen. Mildred could see he was wearing some kind of tight-fitting black bodysuit under his gold-trimmed white robes. The cuffs of the bodysuit came down to his massive wrists and down to his even more massive ankles. The Chief Lord of Death wore heavy rings on every finger and both thumbs. They were silver or stainless steel, and the centers of each were adorned not with gemstones, but with substantial 2-inch-long steel points. Miniature broadhead arrow tips. Together, they made up a particularly wicked set of brass knuckles. With a straight punch or a raking slash, they could cut to the bone. Potipool 10 also had what looked like shiny, black-painted fingernails, and they were a half-inch long and cut into sharp points. It was an odd and unsettling affectation. The bleacher seats bowed as Potipool 10 used them as steps to descend to the court floor. He was not a lightweight by any means. On a leather thong around his right wrist, he carried a fearsome weapon. It was shaped like an oversized machete, heavy-bladed, single-edged, and 30 inches long. In the hands of a large, athletic person, such a cleaver could make a head fly off a neck or an arm jump clear of a shoulder joint in one swipe. The rows of unmoving, grotesquely masked lords above, and this one lumbering down the bleachers like a bear in a Halloween suit, was something out of a grade B horror movie. The beast stopped in front of the kneeling Nibor.
My lord, the military campaign in Tierra de la Muerte was a complete success. The entire population was destroyed, save for the slaves before you. The Matachin are stronger than ever, and but wait to go out in your name and conquer again.
This is all you brought me? Fine will not be nearly enough.
Nibor's eyes squinched shut, and his breath fogged the concrete.
It is my fault, my lord. I have failed you.
Mildred was surprised that Nibor didn't try to pass the buck to Casacampo. But maybe he knew bringing up the name would only increase Potipool 10's wrath, because the Matachin commander wasn't there to be punished in the flesh. The chief lord of death ignored his pleas and stomped out onto the middle of the ball court, stopping to loom over the prostrated and benetted Daniel DeCipio.
Don't worry, you will have more brothers and sisters soon. Dr. Yorte will see to that.
Oh, please, no!
Creature, it is your privilege to supply the Lords of Death with what we demand. Your diseased bones will make the weapons to bring this world to its knees. And in return for your servitude, we will feed and clothe you and let you live.
The other lords hissed through the mouth holes in their masks, not in disapproval. Apparently, the noise was their way of applauding. None of them moved, so Mildred still couldn't tell which of the figures were real and which were just dummies. When Potipool 10 turned in her direction, she quickly shifted her gaze to the floor under her nose. She had a bad feeling in her gut. By brothers and sisters, did Potipool 10 mean this Dr. Yorte was going to thaw out more carriers from the cryotanks? Or did he mean Dr. Yorte was going to make some more carriers using Daniel's donor marrow? Mildred was having trouble swallowing the whole thawing business. It was chock full of logical problems, and the timeline didn't make any sense either. Successful thawing from cryogenesis was a complicated procedure even when automated, because there were so many variables to monitor and compensate for. Relative tissue densities, differential trehalose absorption. Trehalose was the natural sugar that kept the internal components of living cells from freezing solid and cell walls from being ruptured by expanding ice, and variable antifreeze concentrations in organs and bones. Critical hydration and nutrient loss to specific tissues during the stresses of reanimation. The list went on and on. The convicts who first took over the prison were likely uneducated and mentally ill, if not completely deranged. How could they figure out how to unfreeze the carriers? Furthermore, how could the 8th generation of offspring of the convicted murderers figure it out? Long before the Fire Talker was revived, there were no white coats left to demonstrate or oversee the procedure. The convicts could have been trained by white coats from day one, and the training then passed down through the years, but for that to have happened, the Koiba prisoners would have had to anticipate that circumstances would demand deployment of the bioweapon at some point in the future. It was hard to believe that the convicts could have had that kind of foresight or that amount of patience. or the willingness to tempt fate, having seen firsthand what the Whitecoats' failures had suffered. Yet the necessary information and skills had been transferred, or Daniel would never have been revived. According to the Fire Talker, when he woke up, the Atipuls were already in situ here, and had been for more than a century. He had accepted what he was told, that the Lords of Death were part of the bloodline of the original convicts, and that the pirates had turned themselves into gods, using Inanios as their instruments. There was no way of testing either of those hypotheses. The total annihilation of the population of Panama City, which ran counter to Matachin's self-interest, seemed to reflect unfamiliarity with the weaponized disease. Apparently, the Atipuls had no idea how deadly the plague was until they used it the first time. And then, there was the hellhole factor. The Lords of Death and their groveling subjects all seemed blind or oblivious to the squalor they inhabited. It was like they were living in a dream world far, far from this wretched place. Xibalba was the seat of the Lord's authority and their supposed spiritual power. But it was a shit pit. The more Mildred considered all this, the more puzzling it became. Then Atipul 10 stepped up right beside her, and every other thought vanished from her mind. The chief lord gave off a distinctly unpleasant odor. It was fusty and sour. It reminded her of something she couldn't quite place, but she found the vague memory disturbing nonetheless. The toes sticking out of the sandals were webbed, and the nails, crescent moons of ebony, looked like talons. Were they the product of plastic surgery? Some kind of synthetic implants? Then Atipul 10 touched the bare back of her neck, and she felt the points of those thick black fingernails drag across her skin. Mildred squeezed her eyes shut and pressed her nose into the concrete. She, who had traveled through time, who had already died once, who had shot and stabbed her way across a ruined continent, hadn't been this terrified since she was a little girl. It was more than just the smell, the sight, the touch of this creature. Mildred sensed there was no humanity there, no semblance of humanity. Human evil had its own limits, its comprehensible limits. Like every other Homo sapien, Mildred could envision the range of harm that could be done to other people. Like everyone else, she could imagine doing most of it herself, even if she never intended to and never would. This creature was not limited by those natural boundaries. Whatever boundaries Atipul 10 had, if he had any, they were inscrutable.
Nemor, take them away!
Atipul 10 turned back for the bleachers. Mildred and the others were summarily hauled to their feet and quick marched out of the same gymnasium doors they'd entered, this time with all the Whitecoats marching in front of them. The warrior priests pushed them into a sally port, a hurricane-fenced corridor that had originally kept prisoners from wandering around the yard. Evening was closing in. The sky above the clearing was shot with salmon pink and turquoise. Mildred was very relieved to be out in the open air. Doc glanced at her.
That went well.
Compared to what?
Look behind us.
She glanced back in time to see Daniel DeCipio go limp. Two of Nibor's Sekhmen grabbed him and lugged him along by the armpits, dragging the toes of his boots in the dirt. Christy shook her head.
Wherever he's going, it doesn't look like fun.
The Whitecoats veered off toward the more recent-looking structure. Unlike the prison block that loomed to their left, this building had windows, and once it had plate glass doors, which had been broken out and replaced with plywood scrap. Daniel and his bearers veered off as well. One of the Whitecoats held the door open, and the Fire Talker was dragged inside. Over the door, a crudely lettered sign hung at an odd angle. JB squinted at it through his spectacles.
Casa de la Navaja. What is that?
Razor House. That building's called Razor House. It's a reference taken from the ancient Mayan legends. In the Xibalban creation myths, it was supposedly filled with sentient knives that could fly. In this incarnation, it's the Whitecoat Surgical Center.
Nibor, seemingly totally unconcerned at their chatter, and his men led the companions past a single-story arm of the L-shaped prison block. It also bore a sign.
Casa de Frio?
That would be cold or a rattling house, where they store the bioweapon freezies, no doubt.
A second separate structure looked like it had once been a maintenance shed. As they walked past, the door shook as something slammed into it.
Casa de Balam.
Jaguars.
Since when did jaguars bark?
They've substituted wild dogs for the jaguars in the myth. It's understandable. Jaguars are probably few and far between on this island.
Well, what's the point of all these houses, anyway?
According to the legends, they provided tests that would either kill or humiliate visitors to Xibalba. The goal was to outwit the test and survive, only to be confronted by the next test, and the next. They got worse as they went along.
Must have cut down on tourism.
Xibalba was supposed to be hell for regular folks. Whoever applied the myths to this place doesn't have a clue what they were really about.
Nibor opened a heavy, riveted metal door in the windowless wall ahead of them. As the door swung back, Mildred could see the faint glow of electric lights. The bulbs throbbed in time with the generators. Then, out of the doorway, there came a rush of leathery wings just over their heads. All of the companions ducked reflexively.
Don't tell me. It's Bathhouse.
The prison's interior was in no better shape than the outside. The corridor between the two-story high tiers of cells was gritty, littered with refuse, mildewed and dank. The cells' steel bars looked rusted, but they were 2 inches in diameter, still plenty thick enough to do the job. All five companions were shoved into the same narrow, low-ceilinged cell. It only had 4 bunks. There were no mattresses, just metal bed frames suspended by chains eye-bolted into the concrete. There was a bucket for a toilet and a bucket for water. They sat side by side. The toilet hadn't been emptied in a while. Across the corridor in the cell opposite, another prisoner dozed on a top bunk in a sitting position, leaning with his back against the concrete wall. The sound of the cell door clanging shut didn't wake him up. In the dim light, it looked like his holdout yellow sweat-stained shirt had been fitted with a pair of shiny black epaulets. Then the epaulets fluttered their pointy wings and changed attack angles. Not just any bats, as it turned out. Blood from open wounds spilled down the prisoner's chest. Maybe he was already dead. Bats in droves were shooting back and forth down the hallway, darting and diving between the bars into the occupied cells.
We'd best take turns sleeping.
Who the hell's going to sleep?
Ryan gave up trying to sleep. It wasn't the snoring of Tom and Chucho that kept him awake. It wasn't the stink of the Mattachine commander or their newly captured pirate from the Panama City Yacht Club tied to chairs 5 feet away. It wasn't the 8 dead men he was sharing the room with. He was thinking about his friends, about what they had to be suffering, about what kind of a lead their captors had. And he was chomping at the bit to be off after them. But outside the Panama City Yacht Club, it was still pitch dark. There was no way to pick up the pursuit before dawn. Not across more than a couple hundred miles of unfamiliar waters in an unfamiliar ship. The previous evening, the four of them, Tom, Chucho, Casacampo, and Ryan, had arrived on horseback. This after 3 full days in the saddle. Riding along the city's deserted Bayfront Avenue, on the other side of the harbor, they had seen the boats tied up off the old yacht club. They had also seen the ancient plague warning signs along the road. Both Tom and Ryan had demanded that Casacampo tell them the story of what happened. The commander obliged as they rounded the shore of the bay. Casacampo was wearing pants, and had been since the first night in Cologne. Chucho had relented on the no clothes issue, but it wasn't because he felt sympathy for the bastard. He just didn't want him to get saddle sores on his bare ass and be unable to walk, which would have slowed them. That little bit of mercy sure turned Casacampo into a chatty bastard. The commander had assured them there was no plague anymore, but there were no people left in the city, either. They had all been killed. He said it had happened 30 years before he was born.
The Mattachine did it?
I only know what they've been told since I was a little boy. Way back when, Panama City was prime for the picking. Richer than Veracruz or any of the cities on the Atlantic. When the Mattachine attempted to take over the city, there was concerted resistance. The people fought back hard when pirates attacked and managed to drive them off the beach. Afterward, the people here realized the threat was not going to go away, that the enemy would keep coming back. So they organized an assault force to root them out and destroy them. Many ships, many guns, many fighters. They were about to send their fleet north to attack Xibalba and kill the Mattachine down to the last man. But the Matashin got wind of their plan and struck first.
Ryan had gestured at the vast city overwhelmed by jungle, groves of mango trees growing up through the asphalt, skyscrapers draped in greenery.
So what went wrong?
As it turned out, the job was much easier than the Lords of Death thought. They sent in too many of their enanos. They didn't know how many they'd need to bring a city of this size to its knees. And once the disease carriers were released and the plague started to spread, they couldn't stop it. It burned like wildfire through every neighborhood and out into the countryside, too. In 2 weeks, almost everyone in the city was dead. The streets were heaped with unburied bodies. The houses and apartments were full of them. Those who didn't die from the plague killed themselves in despair. Only in the last 10 years have we started to explore the edges of the city. There is much booty inside, and not enough Matashin manpower to carry it out, or even to do a thorough search. Cutting back the jungle after all these years, and keeping it cut back, would take 10,000 slaves, maybe more.
Ryan rose to his feet, stepped over the sprawled bodies of the warrior priests, and walked to the picture window. He could just make out the broad, glassy bay in the starlight. The four of them had spent 2 nights under even worse conditions in the pirates' hillside bunkers as they worked their way across the isthmus. As the evenings approached, he and Tom had noticed a change in Chucho and Casacampo's demeanor. A nervousness gripped them both. An urgency. When Ryan had remarked on it, Chucho had pinned him with an earnest, one-eyed stare.
As long as we ride quickly and reach the shelter before nightfall, there will be no problems. The jungle is very thick and the road is narrow. Many bad things come out after dark.
You mean animals or men?
No one knows what they are. Things happen, though. People disappear along this trail without a trace. Entire mule trains just vanish. The forest is too thick to try to track them. It isn't like it used to be.
What do you mean?
It is much more dangerous in these parts than it was before Nuke Day. There are things here now that didn't used to be here. No one knows why. No one knows where they came from. No one has ever seen them and lived to tell about it. These things do not show themselves until it is too late.
Ryan had seen nothing and heard nothing as dusk gathered around them, but he respected Chucho's word. Even though he had wanted to push on, riding into the night to gain more ground on the companions, he hadn't pressed the issue. Before dark, they were bolted in behind the bunker doors. Taking the yacht club from the warrior priests had been less of a challenge than the 3-day ride. When push came to shove, and when Chucho was doing the pushing, Casacampo cared more about living than he cared about his fellow Matachin. He didn't like it, but he went along with it. After dark, they had forced Casacampo to pound on the clubhouse door with his fists and call out to the men inside, demanding shelter. The bad things out at night didn't knock, and they didn't ask for help. When the door opened, Ryan, Tom, and Chucho had pushed the commander through it in front of them and shot all but one of the unsuspecting men into oblivion. While Tom secured their new prisoner and kept an eye on Casacampo, Ryan and Chucho had rebolted the door to keep out whatever it was that had made Chucho and Casacampo both tense and unable to look away from the impenetrable jungle gloom. Unable to sleep and not wanting to disturb Tom or Chucho, Ryan turned away from the window. He picked up a lantern and poked around the rest of the yacht club. In a back room closet, he discovered 5 Soviet RPD light machine guns and extra drum mags of 7.62mm rounds. He field-stripped and checked the weapons and found them to be well-oiled and in shooting shape. He had them lined up and ready by the front door when, just before dawn, Tom woke up. The traitor stretched and sat up.
Slept like the dead.
Then he looked over at the heap of corpses in the corner.
Well, on second thought, maybe not. Couch sure beats a horse blanket on the ground, though.
After waking Chucho, Casacampo, and the prisoner, they lugged the backpacks of C4 and detonators, their submachine guns, and the RPDs and ammo outside. Dawn was just breaking behind them. In front of them, the pirates' commandeered navy sat peacefully at anchor. Tom turned to Ryan and Chucho.
We need better than a 500-mile range. There may not be any way to refuel once we get there. We have to be able to make it back on whatever's in the tanks.
Makes sense. How long will it take to figure out which one will do?
Chucho grinned and pushed the tip of his blaster into the flesh of the newly captured pirate's cheek.
Well?
Without hesitation, the prisoner pointed straight out at a yellowing 45-foot Hatteras with flybridge.
All right, then. Let's move.
They loaded a rowboat tied to the yacht club dock and made Casacampo and the prisoner row them over to the stern of the sport fisher. Tom boarded ship first. He scampered up the stainless steel ladder aft of the main cabin and cranked over the engines using the flybridge auxiliary controls. The diesels roared to life, and a huge plume of black smoke erupted from the exhausts. After a little feathering of the throttles, the smoke belching aft turned white, then became invisible.
Oh yeah, this'll do just fine.
Ryan climbed aboard and helped Casacampo through the transom gate.
On your belly on the deck.
After the commander complied, Chucho started passing up the guns and explosives. Tom let the engines idle while he descended the flybridge, ran for the bow, and started winching up the anchor. When all the materiel was transferred from the rowboat, Ryan looked at the prisoner at the oars, then at Chucho.
What about him? Are you going to shoot him or should I?
What's he going to do here by himself? And besides, someone has to live to tell the tale, right?
Well, I don't care either way. Swim, you lucky asshole.
The man's face brightened. Without a word, he dived over the side and started stroking hard for shore. After shifting the guns and C4 to the salon, they tied Casacampo securely to the stern scupper, then joined Tom up on the flybridge.
If we follow the coastline, we can't miss Coiba. It's 8 or 9 hours away, depending on how much speed I can squeeze out of this boat.
The trader pushed down the twin throttles and the Hatteras responded, surging forward, splitting the mirror surface of the bay. The sun was only half an hour up, and it already was getting hot. Dressed in a pale blue paper hospital gown, Daniel DeCipio sat manacled to a wheelchair in the hallway outside the office of Dr. Dolan Yorte, awaiting a surgical procedure he was all too familiar with. If Daniel could have touched the floor with his tiptoes, he would have tried to toe-tap the wheelchair out of the building. If he could have reached his wrists with his teeth, he would have tried to gnaw through them. But due to the head and ankle restraints, he could do neither. So he was forced to simply sit and wait for the horrible inevitable. The White Coat building had been added to the prison after the secret deal was struck for use of the site and the convicts as guinea pigs. The cost came out of the black box budget of Project Persephone. Construction materials and laboratory equipment had been choppered in from a U.S. Army base on the mainland, and they'd been assembled by a company of Army engineers. Over a century of hard use, the original white acrylic tiles had turned dingy yellow, and here and there had curled up from the subfloor like oversized tortilla chips. There were rust stains on the acoustic drop ceiling, and deep scrape marks along the white enameled walls where countless gurneys had grazed them. As the door to Yorte's office was open, the fire talker could see inside. The far wall was covered from floor to ceiling with sketches of demons on scraps of paper of various sizes, wild renderings by the head white coat and chief surgeon of hell himself, in thick strokes of black marker with bold highlights of red. The doctor first dreamed the hideous faces he constructed, or so he claimed, after drinking enormous quantities of mescal. He claimed that the Lords of Death visited him with visions of their progeny when he was in an advanced, intoxicated state, and that they gave him detailed instructions on how to make the visions real. Cut this, sew that, insert plastic chin here. It was a revelation that had always puzzled Daniel. But so much of what surrounded him in this place was difficult to make sense of, and not worth the trouble of trying, because he was at best a pawn in whatever his masters were about. At worst, a lab rat. The only thing that kept the surgeon's colossal ego in check was fear. Fear of the Lords of Death. Yorte came into view in the doorway, his lab coat stained with drops of blood or perhaps hot sauce. Pushing his hair back from his eyes with both hands, he glared about in frustration till his gaze landed on Dr. Monteo and his two assistants. The man frowned, still deeply pissed at the number and quality of subjects Monteo had brought back. He seemed particularly upset by the choice of the geezer with the perfect teeth and the albino. Daniel knew that Monteo had washed out as a Chevalbin plastic surgeon, although many of his attempts were still lurching around the prison yard.
He had been relegated to Inanno babysitting duties and light defrostings, things he couldn't screw up.
Dr. Yorte stormed out of his office and confronted his wheelchair-bound patient. Yorte pushed back his flyaway hair and stared down at Daniel.
Well, Inanno, how about I remake you on the outside while I'm at it? I can make it match the inside. Maybe you'll wake up with a face like a monkey's anus.
Daniel knew better than to banter with the man when he was in a friable mood and about to begin surgery. He kept his lip zipped. Monteo and the Bruyas wheeled him down the hall to the surgical site, a trip he had relived in nightmares countless times. This was his fifth excursion into the realm of pain beyond belief. Because he was already semi-sedated, the trio had little trouble shifting him from the chair to the crucifixion table. They pinioned his wrists, chest, waist, and ankles with heavy leather belts, pulling them so tight he couldn't move and could hardly breathe. One of the assistants put an IV line into his forearm, slung a saline bag, and then used a syringe to inject him with something. Dope. Although it hit him between the eyes like a 2x4, he remained fully conscious. He wanted to ask the grinning bitch to give him more, but he knew there wasn't enough dope in the world to dull the agony of marrow harvesting. Besides, he couldn't make his mouth move. That, he decided, was the real purpose of the narcotic, to keep him quiet while they mined his very bones. Dr. Yorte pushed a stainless steel tray on wheels beside the table. From a towel, he picked up a hypodermic needle of impressive length and unholy diameter. At the end opposite the point, it had a kind of bolt head with six faceted sides. A Bruya pulled Daniel's gown away from his hip, daubed it with betadine, then Yorte rammed the needle into his pelvis, hard enough to seat its hollow tip in the bone. Now that hurt, no denying. A steady, stinging pain that shot up and down his leg, but it was nothing compared to what came next. Dr. Yorte snatched a crescent wrench from the instrument tray, fitted it to the bolt head, then made a quick adjustment of the gap. Jaws nice and tight, he used the wrench's leverage to turn the needle and drive the point into the marrow. Supposedly one of the litmus tests of whether a bone was broken or not was the person's reaction to the shock. If he or she passed out or puked from the pain, the bone was probably broken. Daniel's bone wasn't broken, but he turned his head anyway, over the side of the table. Screwing the needle deep enough was slow, difficult work for the corer, and excruciating agony for the coree. Was it worse than he had remembered it? Or was it that something that bad couldn't be remembered? It could only be re-experienced. As he trembled and twitched in the restraints, Daniel tried to recall what it was like being an ice cube for 100 years. He was desperately searching for happy thoughts. When the needle had been augured in to sufficient depth, the pain was constant and unrelenting. His entire body vibrated from it. Yorte then fitted a plastic tube to the back of the needle and used a squeeze bulb, like a turkey baster's, to suck out the marrow. The cells were a brilliant red as he spritzed them from the blaster into a stainless steel basin. Then, the good doctor went back for more. In the midst of his delirium of pain, Daniel started to hallucinate. Suddenly, it wasn't Dolan Yorte working the rubber bulb, but the 5'2" publisher of SR. This while he puffed away on a foot-long cigar. Behind the homunculus, in the hard glare of the surgical lights, Daniel saw the familiar outlines of his heroes. They, too, had gathered around his bed of pain. There was pushing and shoving between them, and the usual hurling of threats.
Use your broadsword, Ragnar! Cut off that motherfucker's head!
The red pigtailed Norseman made no move to draw his weapon.
Let me see him! Your rapier! Skewer his guts!
The patriarch of the celery people wouldn't be interrupted. He was caught up secretly sticking bubblegum in Ragnar's hair. Daniel didn't even bother with the princess. She was applying fresh dabs of rose pink to the centers of her buckskin-hued cheeks.
You ungrateful bastards! I breathe life into you! Oh, and this is what I get in return?
The heroes of SR blinked at him for a moment, then returned to whatever it was they were doing. As the needle was slowly rotated out of his hip with the wrench, Daniel nearly passed out. In the middle of the exit procedure, Dr. Yorte paused, turning to Monteo and the Brujas as he tapped the stainless steel basin with the jaws of the crescent.
Yeah, not so much yield from his pelvis. Maybe we have finally drained him dry. Maybe we should suck the cells from his spine. Oh no, wait a minute. I forgot. He doesn't have one.
Then it was time for the other hip to give up its treasure. The big bore needle pierced flesh and penetrated a quarter inch into the bone. The crescent wrench clanked hard against the bolt head, sending undulations of agony down Daniel's leg. Then the needle corkscrewed into him again, round and round, with Yorte leaning on the wrench.
Oh, mommy!
Doc Tanner was awakened from a dreamless sleep by a hard shaking.
Get up! Get up, damn it!
When he opened his eyes, he saw that Mildred had already roused everyone else in the cell. Doc swung his legs over the edge of the steel platform that served as a bed.
What is it? What's so important?
They're going to infect us with Daniel's disease. I figured it out.
You mean we're going to start writing bad science fiction and then have the audacity to defend it?
No, you idiot. They're going to give us what killed the people of Padre. They're going to try to make us into carriers like DeCipio.
JB crossed his arms and glowered.
Nuke in hell, they are.
If we cannot stop them from doing that, I, for one, do not intend to live a second so sullied. I will find a way to end the wretchedness forthwith, even if I have to dash my own brains out against the nearest wall.
Our only chance is when the guards come to take us away. We've got to jump them when they open the cell.
This is hold back nothing time. If we can get out of here, maybe we can snatch some blasters and turn this dump upside down.
Doc thought the plan was just simple enough to work. As he listened for the sound of the guards' footsteps on the concrete. They would rush the open door all at once, using the mass of their bodies to overwhelm and pull down the closest Marachin, then to block the closing of the cell. With the door wedged open, they would take out their other guards with a human wave before they could cry for help or respond with deadly force. Once they were out of commission, keys for the cuffs and weapons could be confiscated. A good plan, but it didn't take into account one thing. The fire hose. When the cell door opened, the companions rushed it in unison. Doc managed to get a hold of the guard's arm, and that fraction of a second delay allowed the others to pile on. From out of nowhere, a stream of high-pressure water slammed them through the bars. It was like being kicked in the chest by a mule. The force of the impact lifted Doc off his feet and slammed him against the back of the cell.
Five, three, Kennedys!
He lowered his head and threw himself toward the exit, only to be driven back again. The guards hosed them down until they stopped struggling, until they were exhausted trying to fight the force of the water. Then the companions were dragged out one by one like drowned rats. They had tried, but in the end, all it had added up to was a soapless shower, fully clothed. When his turn came, Doc was dragged out of the cell block, down the sally port, and through the front door of the Razor House. Inside, he was plopped down in a wheelchair and rolled into an examination room. Where the others had been taken, he had no clue. There was no sign of them, but there were other closed doors along the corridor. The sights and the odors of the medical unit made him flashback to his first time trawl and his first interaction with Whitecoats. Dr. Dolan Yorte breezed into the room, brushed back his overlong hair with a precise two-handed sweep, handed some papers to the little female white coat in attendance, brushed back his hair a second time, then breezed out, slamming the door after him. In those brief moments, Doc took what he believed was the full measure of the man. Yorte's insecurities, both professional and personal, were vast, perhaps bottomless. And they were coupled with and confounded by a manic energy, an excess of narcissism, and uncrackable pig-headedness. The sweet-faced little white coat leaned closer and smiled at Doc.
Let me help you out of those wet clothes.
I think not, madam.
There are things I must do before we can proceed. I must conduct a thorough physical examination to identify any health problems that need to be treated. I must draw some of your blood for testing.
What is the ultimate goal of this exercise?
You are to be given the Mujeres sickness, of course, in the hope that you will survive the disease as a carrier and thereby replace the enanos who were lost in the campaign in Tierra de la Muerte.
Mujera? I don't know that word.
La Mujera. The man who whines and fusses like a little woman.
Oh, you mean the fire talker, Daniel.
The sickness is very, very bad.
The white coat made a serious face, complete with brow furrows and pouted lips.
I know. I have seen it.
Dr. Siorte and Montejo will make sure you catch it. And when you do, there will be fever, vomiting, diarrhea, delirium, and the red boils all over the skin. You will be sick for a very long time. If you live through it, you will serve the lords of death, like Daniel.
If not, I will be dog food.
The Bruja nodded, her eyes glittering merrily.
Why do you not take off my shackles?
Why would I do that?
Because I like you very much.
Her eyes grew wide in surprise, but she smiled.
You and I could go off into the jungle and be very happy together. We could make large numbers of little ducks and brujas. We could raise spotted pigs and eat papaya and guanabana every day. This place is a hellhole. You deserve so much better.
No. Can't you see I am a serious professional? I have a career to think of.
Where exactly did you get your training?
Lo sé des.
I beg your pardon?
Oh, wait. It's too hard to explain. I show you.
The little woman disappeared, then came back with a handful of flat, black plastic cases.
Lo sé des.
The covers had no pictures or photos to identify their contents, just slips of paper on which were printed multisyllabic words in Spanish. The titles were uniformly uninspired. Implantation surgery, facial reconstruction techniques, viral load management, cryogenic reanimation, recovery, relapse, and morbidity. The discs looked homemade, or at least home-copied, and they appeared to cover the specific tasks required of Xibalban whitecoats, which was very convenient. Perhaps the last real whitecoat standing had made them, or perhaps they were the products of the Lords of Death?
I do not know what these are.
If you live through the sickness, we will watch them together, perhaps. You will need to wear protection, though.
But you mean a condom?
You don't understand. After the procedure, you will be an enano. You won't be allowed out without a net suit. Otherwise, you might kill everyone. One little mosquito, you know. Unless you are the lords of death.
What do you mean?
Mosquitoes don't ever bite them. Don't like their smell, some people say.
I like your smell.
Doc thought he was making some headway. Sex was not the primary thing on his mind. It was a means to an end. The end being getting free of his shackles and then freeing his companions from theirs.
If you and I do not consummate our relationship post-haste, we never will. Once I am infected with the disease, romantic love will be impossible for me. This is our only chance, my dear. Come on, you have me at a disadvantage. I cannot move my arms or legs. You could have your way with me, and I could not stop you.
It's tempting.
It has been a long time since I have enjoyed the company of a beautiful and willing woman. And if what you say is true, I will not be able to do so ever again without killing her. How can you deny me a last taste of passion?
He glanced down at his crotch, made sure she was looking, then spread his knees as best he could with his feet tied.
I am not a small man.
He's very tempting.
Well?
The Bruja bit her lower lip as she carefully mulled over the offer. Doc imagined that he could hear the gears of her mind ticking over. They ticked very, very slowly. Finally, she shook her head.
No. I'm sorry. I can't do it. You are an attractive man, and you are very charming, but there is too much for me to lose. If the Lords of Death found out, they would throw me to the dogs.